From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, Venezuela. To understand the current state of Venezuela, we need to go back, all the way to 1999. That's when the leader Hugo Chavez came to power. As president, Chavez immediately began implementing socialist reforms in the state's nationalized oil company and other industries. He used that money to expand access to food, healthcare, and education. It cost next to nothing to buy gas.
It now costs a fifth of a US cent, that's a fifth of a penny, to buy a gallon of gasoline in Venezuela. That's based on black market currency.
But all these efforts became unsustainable, and within a decade, Venezuela was gripped in an economic crisis. Chavez died of cancer in 2013, bringing then-Vice President Nicolas Maduro into power. But rather than abandon Chavez's socialist policies, Maduro's response was to begin arresting those in opposition and silencing the press.
Frustrated by government pressure not to cover certain subjects on air, the Bus TV team hops on and off buses around Caracas, delivering the news in person.
In these times, as journalists, we've had to reinvent ourselves in order for information to reach the greatest number of people.
All the while, inflation, crime, and poverty exploded. The people of Venezuela began fleeing by the millions, pouring into neighboring countries in search of food and safety.
The constant stream of refugees out of Venezuela is putting a lot of pressure on neighboring countries. Let's take, for example, the border town of Pacaraima in Brazil, where a mob attacked a group of Venezuelan immigrants over the weekend.
And yet, despite all this, Maduro won another six-year term last May. Critics decried the process. People said votes were rigged. But then this month, something strange happened. After Maduro's inauguration in January, his presidency was challenged by 35-year-old opposition leader Juan Guaido. He's the president of the National Assembly of Venezuela. It was a bold move, but soon after, Guaido was bolstered by the United States, Canada, and other countries, all desperate to back new leadership in Venezuela.
As you know, on January the 23rd, President Trump officially recognized the president of the Venezuelan National Assembly, Juan Guaido, as the interim president of Venezuela. Venezuela's National Assembly invoked Article 233 of the country's constitution to declare Nicolas Maduro illegitimate.
And this week, the Trump administration announced new sanctions in an attempt to squeeze Maduro from power.
We have continued to expose the corruption of Maduro and his cronies, and today's action ensures they can no longer loot the assets of the Venezuelan people. We expect, and Secretary Mnuchin...
So what's next for Venezuela, and what has life been like for Venezuelans who've been enduring these hardships? Here to help us answer these questions is Janina Raffo. She's a human rights activist from Venezuela who came to the United States in 2016. She still works with human rights organizations on the ground in Venezuela, but she prefers that we don't use their names. She's with me here in the studio. You grew up in Caracas.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your childhood.
Yeah, well, I was born in Venezuela mm-hmm. in 1991. I'm from like a normal middle-class family. And our life was not luxurious, but we always have food in our place. We have access to education. We have a house of our own. But suddenly, like, in between 2012 and 2016, everything started falling apart.
So how old are you at that point?
24.
So when you say you grew up in a typical middle-class house, mm-hmm. your parents both work?
Yeah. My mom always teaches art classes, mm-hmm. and my dad worked in a company with mechanical stuff and things like that.
And did you expect, you know, typical middle-class family, you expect to go to college, maybe
right.
graduate school?
Yeah. All my brothers and sisters, they are older than me, have mm-hmm. the opportunity to go to college and have different degrees. So that was what I expected as a middle-class family back then.
How many brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters and one brother.
Big family.
Yeah, it's a big family.
So what starts to change?
We start seeing how, for example, we spend most of our time doing lines for food.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first wake-up call. So my routine, let's say 2015, 2016, was waking up really early, like 6 a.m. in the morning, just to get ready to start doing the line. So what happened is, like, you can only buy food in Venezuela in a specific day. So with your ID, your national ID, the last number of that ID will give you the possibility to buy certain foods. So for me, it was important, for example, on Wednesday, get up really early because it was my day that I could go and buy food. So I start really early and I do an 8-hour line for buying basic goods as rice, chicken, milk. And that became my routine.
So when you're saying an 8-hour line, I mean, is it hundreds of people down the block?
Hundreds of people since really early in the morning, because the last that you wanted is you are in the line and then they suddenly say the food is over. So you have to be there really early.
So one day to the next, when you were, let's say, 10, you would go to a supermarket,
normally.
We do in Washington. You'd go to a Safeway, you'd get your yogurt.
Go to Safeway, get whatever you want. Nobody control you how much food you can have or how many days you can have. So for me, that was kind of very hard because, like, younger, I never have to do that in my life. So I can see clearly what it changed and how much it changed. So
what was your first memory of having to do that?
It was earlier 2015 when we realized that we have to go for different supermarkets because, as you say, we're a big family. Mm-hmm. So we realized we didn't have enough food. Mm-hmm. So we start creating these crazy strategies to try to go to different grocery store to be able to eat. Because before, like, we used to eat 3 times a day, like a normal middle-class family. And then suddenly we start seeing that we miss one meal. Like, maybe we didn't have breakfast or maybe we didn't have dinner because there was no access to the certain goods that we needed. So that was very hard for us trying to adjust to that level of, let's say, poverty that we never experienced before.
Did you have a strategy for standing on the line? I mean, did you have a placeholder? Did you bring books with you? What did you do?
Yeah, this is really interesting because that kind of situations create all this kind of black market or kind of other realities. People that charge you for save your spot in the line, people who sell food in the line, people who sell the same good as in the supermarket, but in much higher prices. So yeah, what I did when it was my mom's turn to buy food, I did the line for her most of the time. And then at the end, when it was her time, I called her, say, "Mom, come really fast because it's your turn to buy the food." Because I didn't want my mom to do like an 8-hour line.
Did you bring a chair with you?
Yeah, like a chair, a book. I like to read about things that explain somehow what was happening in Venezuela, the economic books or maybe politics. So try to understand why this craziness and this crisis was happening.
Did it feel surreal?
It felt very surreal, but at the same time, it gave you a lot of anger because you know this is not how people all around the world lives. Maybe like in Cuba, in countries like that, but not in normal countries. So you say, why we did wrong and why we deserve this?
And who did you blame for that anger?
Well, the government, of course. They are like the ones who implement the policies that create all this mess.
So first you started seeing food shortages. Did you start losing weight?
Of course. Malnutrition is one of the most important problems in Venezuela right now. You cannot afford to eat meat 3 times a week. Meat is really expensive. Chicken, fish is really expensive. And of course, you lose weight and you lose the energy somehow that you have to, you know, do normal things in your normal life.
And people started getting sick.
Of course. And that's another problem. People start getting sick, but the health crisis was also happening. So you get sick and you don't have access to medicines or access to like a nice hospital, things like that.
Your own mother got sick, didn't she?
Yeah.
And what happened?
That was like the breaking point to decide this is not life anymore. So what my mom has is called chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So it's basically a thing that don't allow you to breathe normally. And you need a specific medicine to treat that. If you don't take that medicine every day, your lungs start to fail. So the struggle of my brothers and I every single month was trying to find that exact medicine. In Venezuela, it's extremely expensive. So that feeling that you might not be able to buy the medicine that your mom needs is the worst feeling in the world. And I think that was when we decided that we have to leave Venezuela.
There was one other thing as well. The crime was on the rise and violence. Yeah. What was that like?
Well, to give you like an idea, I was robbed in 1 month, 3 times. In the bus, in the street, in poor areas, in rich areas, was everywhere.
And when you were robbed, were you held up at gunpoint?
Did someone stick sure. All the 3 times. Wow. Going to my house in the bus, got robbed with a gun in my face. Going in the street, somebody put a gun in your face and say, give me everything you want. So like this social destruction is also really present. So you see that it's so much misery that it's a lot of people that go in the street just to rob, to get things for their families.
Were you afraid to go out?
Oh, for sure. I used to work in a place in Caracas called Bellas Artes. It's a really tough place. And I remember that one time my mom told me, just quit. We can find that money any other place. But the fact that you are going there as a young woman by yourself really early in the morning is extremely dangerous. So just don't do it.
So did you start creating strategies for how to get around the city?
Oh, for sure. I used to got these jackets that have different secret pockets. So I put my phone and my ID or some money. And in my purse, I left things like makeup or things like that. So if they rob me, they will just rob the things that I don't care.
And it wasn't just robberies, right? The murder rate rose precipitously.
Yeah. I think last year, a statistic says that 25,000 people were murdered.
And the population is how high?
The population of Venezuela right now is around 33 million.
That's a huge murder rate.
And this is between Caracas and the near cities, not counting the whole thing.
So you had finished college in Venezuela and you were already out working.
Yeah.
Correct? And what were you doing?
I was working in one of the most famous think tanks in Latin America as a pro-freedom, pro-human rights think tanks. And I was doing communications and advocacy campaigns for them.
But there is an opportunity for you to leave. Tell me about the opportunity.
Yeah, I was extremely privileged to have found an organization in the U.S. called Atlas Corp. They basically bring fellows and social change leaders from all around the world for 1 year to serve here in U.S. and learn and grow skills in different topics. So I found it online. By that time, I learned English, but in like YouTube tutorials and things like that. So they really like the work that I was doing with different think tanks and human rights organizations in Venezuela. So they told me that they want to host me as the first Venezuelan in the project. And it was great. I have the opportunity to came here, and it was my ticket out. Without that opportunity, I think it would be really hard to say that I will just live in the U.S. Because, you know, you need like a visa, like a certain things.
What was it like arriving in the United States after living and standing online and waiting for medicines and all that fear? What was it like coming here?
Well, first of all, it was very inspiring how much freedom and how much things I have the opportunity to do here in the U.S. It's funny because the first time I did grocery shopping, I was in a Safeway. And I remember that I took all this stuff and I was trying to explain to the cashier why I got these chickens, why I got these milks. And the woman just stared at me and say, do you have money to pay this? And I say, yes. And she replied, well, I don't care. Why do you need it? But I was so used to have to explain myself why I need to have permission for this. The government of Venezuela control every single part of your life. And for me, like realizing that in the U.S. I don't have to do that, at the beginning it was very nice, but then it became really sad because I realized that I was living under mental slavery. And in that moment, I realized that that thing that Venezuelans consider normal life is not normal.
How did you feel about those you'd left behind?
Well, when I moved with the fellowship to the United States, my family stayed in Venezuela. And that was one of the hardest things I did. One, because I knew that I will have the opportunity to do all this amazing stuff, living in a country like respect my rights, that I can have access to the food I want, to the medicines I want. Meanwhile, there. Mm-hmm. So what I did was start saving as much money as I could because the fellowship, you know, give you a small stipend. But with that money, they can do so many stuff in Venezuela, like nice meals or buy more food that they used to get in the medicine that my mom need. And also to creating a plan, how can I take them from Venezuela, like tickets, visas, rent, and things like that.
So this is for your brothers and sister and your parents?
Yeah.
So did all of them want to go?
Yeah, of course.
So how did you do that?
So my sister always worked. My other sister was living in Spain, so she also helped in the whole process. So we save money as much as I could to pay the tickets. And because my sister was already living in Spain, she has like a place to stay, and she was working, and she knew all the IDs, migration stuff that they needed. So that was key, like the help of my sister, that she was ready out to mm-hmm. help me to, you know, take my family out of Venezuela.
What about your friends?
It's really hard because I still have a lot of friends that live in Venezuela, but also that works against the government. Mm-hmm. So I'm constantly afraid that I might not hear from them again. Some are there in jail. Some are there, nobody knows where they are. Some are like walking, literally walking to Colombia to find a better future for their families. One time I was talking to a very good friend that I went to college with, and she sent me a picture. And she was so skinny in that picture. And I say, oh, wow, you're so skinny. What are you doing? Like the Maduro diet. That's how people call it, like Maduro diet, because you don't eat much, you're very skinny. And she say, well, Gigi, actually, yes, I'm doing the Maduro diet, and I haven't eaten a chicken in 2 months. That completely broke my heart. And obviously, after that, she entered to a program in the border of Colombia. She moved to Colombia, in which she was access to food and medicines and whatever. But imagine, she was lucky to be part of that. There's still millions of people inside Venezuela. Yeah. So it's heartbreaking, but at the same time, I'm so proud from the people that is there, and they're fighting for democracy and freedom, and I tried to help them as much as I could.
It's interesting that you mentioned that some of them are working against the government, because the events of this past week, where Juan Guaido declared himself to be president, seemed to come to many in North America out of the blue.
Right.
To you, I bet it wasn't out of the blue, was it?
For me, it was... We were waiting for something like this happening. However, I have to admit, I didn't have much hope mm-hmm. in the whole process. But then when I realized that Juan Guaido was following the Constitution and he was actually appealing for the rescue of our democratic values, I start believing and I start getting a lot of hope about this whole thing.
What has been the opposition movement until now? How does it work?
Yeah, it's very divided. We used to have a coalition of opposition parties that work against the government, but there were some parties inside that coalition that actually, it seems that they work pro-government. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? That they were following every step that the government say. They were not doing like rallies. They were not making proposals to get out of this government. And that's why I was like, maybe the situation in Venezuela will be this forever, because you need a coalition, mm-hmm. like an opposition coalition, in order to, you know, fight against a dictatorship. And that was not a case in Venezuela. However, with all this Guaido situation and what he represents as a new leader and a youth leader, it has created some kind of momentary union. And you can see that almost everyone is in the same page about what is the next steps, which is very positive.
Where were you when he announced?
I was here in the United States. I was in my office, just in my laptop. And when I saw him with this river of millions of people, and he said that he will be the interim president of Venezuela, and he quoted the articles in the Constitution, I cried. I just cried, because that was, for the first time in years, one little piece of hope that we never had. What he represents right now is we can change, and we can actually have fair elections in the future. And somehow it gave Maduro this face that he's not invincible and he cannot get away with all the human rights violations and things that did to us in the past. This is like a new beginning, but we have to work together in order to make this a reality.
And the U.S. and Canada, a whole bunch of Latin American countries, mm-hmm. all quickly said that they support Guaido.
Yep.
And now the U.S. has put sanctions on Venezuela. Who will those hurt?
Basically, and this is a very important question, this sanction is against government officials.
Okay.
So when people have the narrative saying, oh, the economic crisis in Venezuela is due to the U.S. sanction, that is completely wrong. The crisis in Venezuela, specifically the economic crisis, is due government policies implemented in the last 20 years. They have paralyzed the food production. They have created these controls that they just damage the economy, all these violations of private property. So the fact that they recognize that this dictator cannot decide the life of Venezuelans, or that the oil company PDVSA is not going to be...
That's the national oil company of...
PDVSA. It's not going to be in the hands of these corrupt government officials or whatever. We need to change who has to be in charge of this in order to create a positive change.
And you mentioned earlier that some of your friends are literally walking to Colombia. And I think Colombia has received something like 1 million refugees. Hundreds of thousands are in Peru, mm-hmm. Ecuador, Brazil.
Right.
How are those refugees being received now?
That's very interesting, because at the beginning, of course, all the countries were like, yeah, we welcome you, come here, we know the situation is very hard. But as you say, if 1 million people go to your country, that creates a problem, especially in job, food security. Like, how 1 million people is going to work if you mm-hmm. already have your own social issues within your country? So right now it's very tense, especially in countries like Ecuador.
Mm-hmm.
People doing riots against Venezuela, and people like forcing the government to say you need to get them out of our country, things like that. And I know it's not all of them, but sentiment is really present.
How have you been received in the U.S.?
So in my case, it has been extremely positive. That's why I don't see any of the developments that are happening as a threat to my country, because somehow I know that the values that you represent, which is freedom and democracy and free market, is what we need.
And have you been working to help others leave?
Yeah.
And how do you do that?
So basically, because the inflation is crazy in Venezuela and people don't have access to much things, what I do is support a lot of GoFundMe campaigns or fundraising campaigns that people have online. One to pay for medicines to people, or to leave, to pay the air ticket, the bus ticket. I like to share the stories because I think people deserve a better life.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I'm really committed to the cause of finding support here in the U.S. and other countries to freedom and human rights causes. I think they're working with nothing, and they're doing such an incredible job, and they need help somehow.
Could you see ever going back?
To be honest, 1 month ago, I thought I will never go back to Venezuela. Actually, I don't have a Venezuelan passport anymore. It's expired, and when I try to renew it, they say I was not eligible to do that.
Why?
Yeah, it's crazy. So you go to the consulate, you go to the website, it says no, go to the consulate, do this, do that. So basically, they just created a black market system. I have found people that say, give me $1,000 and I get you your passport. I'm not going to pay $1,000 for my passport. That's my right.
Are you effectively stateless then?
I have another nationality. I have an Italian passport. So I am so lucky. Mm-hmm. But I know friends that they are like in Argentina and Uruguay and other countries. And something bad happened to their families. They cannot go back. They don't have a passport, so they're waiting, because there's people that cannot pay $1,000 for a passport. So as I say, maybe 1 or 2 months ago, I say, this is never going to change, and this is going to be the same story as Cuba, and I have to live in the exile forever. But with everything that is happening in the last weeks, it creates inside of me this sort of new hope, that I see how all these people are against dictatorship and we want to be a democratic country again. So I think in the future it's possible that I would be able to come back. Maybe not to live, but to visit my family, to see my friends, or things like that.
How much risk did Juan Guaido take in making this announcement?
Incredible. He's like one of the most brave people I know. I think it was a sentiment of, if I don't do this, we are going to be under this regime forever. And the most important thing about what is happening is he is the interim president. So it have to be elections, fair elections soon, where they give you an idea that it's not a coup. He's under a big risk, like all the guns, the army is still supporting Maduro.
And what about those that support him? I mean, are they at risk as well?
Of course. But I think everyone at this point has an attitude about this can cost our freedom and even our life, but it's necessary.
There's been some talk even of sending U.S. troops in the direction of Venezuela.
I don't think that will be like an immediate reality, but I have seen how aggressive Maduro is against U.S. diplomats and U.S. officials that are still in Venezuela. And it's funny how he has changed their narrative. At the beginning, he said, you have 20 minutes to leave the country. Then 72 hours, then 1 month. Definitely, he doesn't want like engage with violence to those people because that can give U.S. the right to enter and do something about it.
When you say you don't know if you'd go back, even if you did, it would be to visit, it makes me wonder about the tremendous brain drain, the loss of an entire generation or more than a generation. Do you have a sense of that?
It's very horrible, especially because I know how hard my family worked to give me my education or to have our own house. And right now, we are like creating a new life outside Venezuela. And there will be generations that is going to be outside Venezuela. So the sense that you're losing all the things that you work on is very present. I'm sure that a lot of people that left Venezuela, if all this thing ends, will return. Because we have such a great country in the past. It's not perfect, of course, because nothing is perfect, but a great country that if you work hard, you can be better.
What are you most hopeful about?
I hope that all this transition can be done without more people losing their lives. And I really, really, really hope the ex-president Maduro understand that he have hurt so much, that his policies and Chavez policies that he implemented has destroyed our life. I wanted out of my country. That will be a way that we can start working, like from the outside, from the inside, to rebuild everything that they destroy.
Has the opposition been working from the outside as well?
Yeah, a lot of people has been sent to other countries, or even escaping. I have many friends that work in politics that they have literally to escape, but now they are here in the U.S. or in Europe or whatever, sending humanitarian aid back home, sending resources for organization, spreading the word. So the work that has been done from the outside is also really important to create a narrative that is people fighting for freedom in Venezuela.
What do you miss the most?
Obviously, my friends and conversations and your culture and what you eat, what you like. And I miss the sense of belonging. This is a great country, but at the end, it's not your country. That's why I'm very hopeful that in the future, I can feel that sense of belonging again, even if I don't go back.
To belong.
To belong.
Is there a place that you miss particularly, or a memory that is of the moment before things began to disintegrate that you think of ever?
Yeah. What I think I miss the most about Venezuela is that there has these amazing islands that you can go and they're like gorgeous, but they're not accessible for us anymore. They're so expensive. In the past, you can just go and have a trip with your family, a long weekend, and right now it's completely luxury. Only people who do business with the government or government people can go there. So imagine if the dictatorship ends and we are back to the way that we used to be, my dream would just go back to one of the islands and just stay there and be free.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Janina Raffo. She's a human rights activist from Venezuela who came to the United States in 2016. First Person is produced by Dan Efron and edited by Rob Sachs. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I'm your host. Hi, First Person listeners. I wanted to let you know about a new podcast featuring untold stories of women creating change all over the world. It's called Seeking Peace. Seeking Peace is hosted by Mel Ann Verveer, who, among her many accolades, was the first ever U.S. ambassador at large for global women's issues. Now she runs Georgetown University's Institute for Women, Peace, and Security. In this episode, she interviews acclaimed actress Kristen Bell.
I feel like my goal in life now is to create a world where peace and equality are ubiquitous.
Seeking Peace, a new podcast from Georgetown University, debuts this week. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.